We are finishing up our series. We're actually going to go one more week after this. We're going to do a bonus week. I was going to end with chapter 15 of Exodus. Mark and I were looking at it, and there was just so many good things that we didn't think we could jam it into this week. So we're going to Mark's going to preach on that next week, if the Lord allows, and it will go really good. But we are here finishing up this story, and as we get into the story, I want to ask you, when you think about God, what comes to your mind? There's a good chance that many people among us would think about Jesus, and that's appropriate, and that's good. But what do you think specifically when you think about the God of the Old Testament? Do you think Jesus then, or do you think something different, someone different? Here's how one author described how he understood the God of the Old Testament. It says, the God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction. Jealous and proud of it. A petty, unjust, unforgiving control freak. A vindictive, bloodthirsty, ethnic cleanser, misogynistic, homophobic, racist, one who kills infants. Genocidal, filicidal, which is a parent who kills a son or a daughter, someone who causes infectious diseases, a megalomaniacal, obsessive for desire or power, a sadomasochistic, the giving or receiving of pleasure from acts involving the receipt of inflicting pain or humiliation, capricious, impulsive, unpredictable, malevolent, bully. Is that the God that came into your mind? I hope not. This is from the book called The God Delusion, published in 2006. It was written by Richard Dawkins, who was a very famous atheist. And as he read through the Bible, the Old Testament, this is the conclusion that he came to. And you might be thinking, like, what is going on inside that guy that he came up with this? Well, we're definitely shaped by the things that happen to us. Our story, our lives influence the way that we interpret and see things. And I'm sure that was a factor. But it wasn't the only factor. He read the Bible. I haven't read the book. I've seen a couple of interviews with him, very brief interviews. But he had to have done his research. And when he read through the Old Testament, he saw things here that helped him come to this conclusion. Why? Why did he do that? For sure, it was shaped by his experience, but he had to have something else. There's something, a way that he interpreted the Bible that led him to this conclusion. And we're going to look at a story, we're going to look at a chapter, a very famous story that we know and love, and for some of us that have grown up in church, we think that this is a wonderful time, this is a wonderful thing. But I think that Dawkins, when he read through this, he would see some things that we probably would miss. And he interpreted God, his understanding of who God is, in a very different way than I do, and hopefully from what you do, because I don't believe that this is the God of the Old Testament at all. But if you read the Bible carefully, and if you read it not very carefully, then I could see how you could come to some of these conclusions. So as we look at this chapter, you're going to see how Richard Dawkins takes some things, doesn't understand it correctly, but he twists it a little bit, or it's twisted for him a little bit. There's lots of lies within that statement that he had, but it's based upon a ton of truth. And that's the way that the evil one works a lot, is he takes a lot of truth and he just distorts it, just a little bit, slightly, subtly. But it sets you off on the wrong path, and before you know it, you're far away from the truth, but you believe it's the truth. I mean, he thinks that we're delusional. I think that he's deceived. But he would say the same thing about me. So let's read the Bible. Look through it. Let me explain how I understand what the Bible has to say, and hopefully you'll come to the same conclusion that I do, or at least a very similar one. But if you don't, that's your decision, your choice. But I hope to convince you otherwise. So let's go and get into Exodus. We're going to start back. We're going to double back into Exodus 13, verse 17. And this is where Mark touched on this a little bit at the end of his sermon last week. And the book of Exodus, we've been going through it. We started at the beginning, and if you haven't read through it, then hopefully you can. It doesn't take very long to get back up to date. And you know a lot of these famous things. I mean, for a very brief overview, the Israelites are enslaved in Egypt. They're calling out to God. They're actually just calling out to anybody for rescue. God hears them and decides to rescue them. So he sends Moses in. Moses and Aaron do all these remarkable miracles, these plagues that are judgment from the Lord onto Pharaoh, onto Egypt because of their disbelief. And the final one was the death of the firstborn son for anybody that did not have the blood of the lamb, the sacrificial lamb, on the doorpost. And you can read through that. That's the first part of the chapters, and that's just a basic review. And that's the one that actually got to Pharaoh. At that point, after all these plagues, the 10th one, he finally says, you want to go? Go ahead and go. Just go. Everybody can go. And he doesn't have any qualms. He doesn't have any hesitations. He says, go, go, go. In fact, go and bless me, because the Lord is obviously against me in this. He doesn't say that, but you can get that feeling that he's a broken man at this point. So God gives them some instructions about what they're to do as they go out, and that's where we pick it up in chapter 13, verse 17. When Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them by the way of the land of the Philistines, although that was near. For God said, lest the people change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt. But God led the people around by the way of the wilderness towards the Red Sea. And the people of Israel went up out of the land of Egypt equipped for battle. Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for Joseph had made the sons of Israel solemnly swear, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones with you from here. Now that's referring to a promise made over 400 years ago that Joseph made at the end of Genesis, is in Genesis 50. And at that time, he's looking towards death, and he sees all his kinsmen, all the Israelites around him, and he recognizes that God's going to do something. Eventually, they're not going to live in Egypt forever. And he says, when you guys go, take my bones with you. When you go, when God delivers you, rescues you out of this plan and gives you into the land, the promised land, where he promised Abraham back in the day, when he fulfills that, I want to be a part of it. Even though I'm not alive physically here on earth, I want to be a part of that. Take my bones into the land. Now, this is remarkable. 400 years. 400 years. The United States of America has been around almost, not quite, but we're getting closer to 250 years. We still have another 150 years to go to get to where they were when they were enslaved. And they kept track of Joseph's bones. My family has a hard time keeping track of library books for 2 weeks. 400 years they've got it. Now I recognize they put him in a coffin and, you know, it was a very special thing. But that is remarkable. And it tells us that they remembered something about the past and that Joseph knew something about the future. He had faith in what God was going to do. Let's look and see what happens here in verse 20. It says, they moved on from Succoth and encamped at Etham on the edge of the wilderness. And the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of cloud to lead them along the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, that they might travel by day and by night. The pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night did not depart from them before the people. So the Lord is in this cloud, this fire, and he is leading and guiding people. And you can learn a lot about somebody when you start to follow them. I mean, just think about the times that you follow people. And most importantly, easily seeing this, is when you follow somebody when they're driving. You're a passenger in the car. You learn lots of things about somebody when they are driving and you are in the car as a passenger. Tons of stuff. I mean, you know some people, you're on a trip and you're like, you know what, I need to make a right in about half an hour. Better get in the right lane right now. Just go ahead, plan ahead. Some people go ahead and get over that way. And you know other people that are taking a half-hour drive, and they're like, you know what, I want you to see this one flower that I saw when I was 6 years old. It was amazing. It's only a 45-minute detour, but that's okay. We've got the time. Let's go. Now, it's around here some way. I know I'll see it when I see the yellow house on the brick road. And you're like, what in the, who am I riding with? When are we going to get home? I mean, you learn lots of things of where people are going to be, their focus, their attention is. Some are definitely on the road, hands 10 and 2, looking at the mirror. You got other people that are just living inside their head. I mean, there's this time, I asked for permission for this, but there's this time where my wife was driving. She was taking the kids to like a homeschooling group that they did. And Titus was little. He was like maybe 3, 4. It's not that far. It's maybe a 3-minute drive from our house. Driving down Houdershell, and my wife's just thinking about all the things that she has to do, everything that's going on. And all of a sudden, she hears from the back Titus say, Mom, are we going to a new place for school? And she says, no. And he's like, well, why did we blast the old place right there? She just was thinking about something else. Titus, he was the navigation. He's got a GPS in him. He's like, wait a minute. Redirecting, recalculating. You learn a lot about somebody when you follow them. And we're going to look at the story, and we're going to learn a lot about the Lord, how he guides the Israelites through this escape, through this freedom from Egypt. Let's look it up here in chapter 14. Then the Lord said to Moses, tell the people of Israel to turn back and encamp in front of Pi-Hahiroth, between Migdol and the sea, in front of Baal-Zephron. You shall now camp facing it by the sea. I don't know where these places are. There's some confusion for sure about where this actually is. They didn't leave street signs. There was no Google Maps back then. But definitely it's by the sea, and it seems like that they are pinned in. Okay, this is not a place with lots of different options. Well, they're here with their backs to the sea. They're facing the sea. Verse 3, it says, Pharaoh will say to the people of Israel, they are wandering in the land, the wilderness has shut them in. So he's going to look and they're going to be like, where are these guys going? And here's the key verse. Verse 4 is very important for us today. We're going to spend a little bit of time explaining what's going on here. In verse 4 it says, and I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will pursue them, and I will get glory over Pharaoh and all his hosts, and the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord. And they did so. So there's a lot in this verse, and we're going to spend just a little bit of time unpacking what's going on here. Okay, so let's look at the beginning part. He says, I will harden Pharaoh's hearts. Now, if you've been with us, if you're familiar with the story, then you know that this happens regularly throughout the story. Once Moses begins to confront Pharaoh, there's a lot of hardening of his heart going on. And it's very confusing, and it's a little bit disturbing. And this might be one of the things that Richard Dawkins saw and was like, aha, see, here's what I'm talking about. This might be one thing that he had in his mind. But we need to understand exactly what's going on here. And we need to clear up some conceptions of what God is doing and what he's not doing. First, one of the things that we need to know is that this is definitely trying to tell us and communicate that God is sovereign. He is in control of things. There's nothing that's outside of his reach within all creation. It's definitely trying to communicate that. But it's not the only thing it's trying to communicate, and that's not the only thing that we need to know about God. We also need to remember that God is wise. He is all-knowing. God is loving. He is good. God is just. He brings about justice. So in his all-control, it's not just this one aspect of who he is. There's a whole personality, a whole person of who God is that we need to remember when we read through this thing and we read through God's sovereignty. All of who God is always involved in his sovereignty. It's just not one aspect. It's all of who he is. So that's one thing. And here's the other thing that we need to know, is that this is not saying that people are robots. It's not saying that people are puppets. It's not saying that people don't have wills or they can't make choices. That's not what this is saying at all. People can make choices. We make choices all the time. That's not what's going on here. But specifically with this, we need to know that this is talking about Pharaoh. And God is not the only one who has hardened Pharaoh's heart. Again and again, it talks about how Pharaoh hardens his own heart. And we need to remember who Pharaoh is. Before there's any mention about God doing anything on Pharaoh, we can already recognize that he is not a good dude. This is not a Boy Scout. He has been oppressive the Israelites for many years. He has enslaved them. He is not a good person towards them. He is controlling. He thinks himself to be God. So we need to recognize a little bit of what's going on. The hardening of Pharaoh's heart happened way before Moses ever confronted him. Pharaoh hardened his own heart way before anything happened where God said, I'm going to go ahead and harden his heart. And here's one of the ways that we can understand that. We were talking in our group, and Bob was in our group, and he talked about how he either came to this conclusion or read this idea that when God hardens Pharaoh's heart, it's like God's giving him the conviction to do what he really wants to do. It's like God's empowering Pharaoh for his heart to do what he really wants to do. The strength of his conviction. And I found that very helpful. And I think that we're going to see that within this story. We're going to see how God says, look, this is what you chose. This is how your heart is. This is what your desire is. I'm going to give you strength so that you will make a commitment to the choice that you've made. I think that that's part of what's going on here. But on the other side of this, we need to make sure that we don't just stay within this one passage when we think about God interacting with humans' hearts. We need to zoom out and remember who God is. And yes, he is sovereign and he is involved in all aspects of life. And how does he use that? How much does he interact and engage with people on their decisions? So that's a mystery. But we do know one thing. God does not only harden hearts. In fact, far and away, the Bible talks more and more about God and how he interacts with people's hearts. It's about softening their hearts. It's not about hardening them. More and more, you see God talking about how he softens hearts. I'm going to flip over to Ezekiel. I know this is your favorite book, and you probably have lots of tattoos about it on your person. But let me read anyway, just as a review. Ezekiel was a prophet in the Old Testament. This is after King David had lived. This is after the kingdom had been split. This is after the people had been sent out into exile. Okay, so they disobeyed God so much that they had the promised land. They were removed from the promised land. So this is during that time where he's like, look, you have forsaken me. God has said, you have forsaken me. You are worshiping idols. You are far, far from me. I have to bring some judgment. You guys don't get to stay in the promised land anymore. And Ezekiel says this during them, during that time. Here's all the things that they have done wrong, and we're going to pick it up in 36:22. It says, therefore, say to the house of Israel, thus says the Lord God, it is not for your sake, O house of Israel, that I'm about to act, but for the sake of my holy name, which you have profaned among the nation to which you came. And I will vindicate the holiness of my great name, which has been profaned among the nations, and which you have profaned among them. And the nations will know that I am the Lord, declares the Lord God, when through you I vindicate my holiness before their eyes. I will take you from the nations and gather you from all the countries, that's they've been exiled, and bring you into your own land. I will sprinkle clean water on you, and you shall be clean from all your uncleanliness, and from all your idols I will cleanse you. And I will give you a new heart, and a new spirit I will put within you. And I will remove the heart of stone from your flesh and give you a heart of flesh. And I will put my spirit within you and cause you to walk in my statutes and to be careful to obey my rules. The Lord does not only, in fact, I think this is one of the only places here in Exodus with Pharaoh that talks about God hardening somebody's heart. But every time we see somebody turning to the Lord, we know that he has been involved and he has been softening their heart. If you have any desire to love, to know, to worship God, then he has worked on your heart. And he has taken the dead heart, the spiritually dead heart that you were born with, that you chose by rebelling against, he has taken that and he has given you a heart of flesh. This is the picture of salvation. This is a picture of a new covenant, a new way that God will interact with his people. Not outward obedience, but inward transformation that leads to outward shaping to become more like Christ. That's why he says, I'm going to give you my spirit. So as we read about God hardening his heart, let's remember to take the big picture and remember all that that means. God is sovereign, yes, but people are not puppets or robots. Pharaoh hardened his heart long before God did anything. And yet God is so gracious and so good that he takes our hard hearts and he gives us soft hearts, loving hearts, moldable hearts, humble hearts, and he gives us his spirit. So here's what we need to remember. One is when God comes to us, we either harden our heart or we soften it. You're hearing the word. God's hopefully speaking to you. You're listening to him. What are you going to choose to do today? Will you harden your heart or will you soften it? And here's the other thing, too. We should be greatly encouraged that God is involved with the people that we care that are far from God. We need to pray and pray and pray and pray and pray for those who we love, and even those that we don't love, that are far from God, that he would soften their hearts, that they would have ears to hear, so that they could turn and find his embrace. So those are some things that we should keep in mind. So that's one thing that we need to look here at verse 4. And he says, I will harden Pharaoh's heart. So now we have an understanding of what's going on there. And here's something else that I think Dawkins would have a problem with. He says, and then in verse 4, he says, and he, Pharaoh, will pursue them, and I will get glory over Pharaoh and all his hosts. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord. Now, this is something Dawkins would look at, and he would be like, look at that. See, God's an egomaniac. Like, he's just wanting his own glory. He's just out for self-promotion. Look at what he's doing. He wants to make sure that Pharaoh and the Egyptians know who's boss. Well, there is a little bit of truth to that, but that's a very distorted view of what the Bible's presenting here. But it is good for God to seek his glory to be made known. He should not hide that. He needs to put that on display. And here's a couple reasons why it is good for God to display his own glory and why it's not egotistical. But it is good. In fact, it would be harmful for us if God hid his glory. In this place, in this time, he chooses to display it through how he interacts with Pharaoh and the Egyptians. Here's a couple things that we need to know. One is the truth must be known. The truth must be known. God really is God. These people from Egypt, they have ideas of what God is. Lots of gods, many gods. They're deceived. They're lied to. They don't know the truth. They need to know the truth. God is going to show them the truth, and it's good that he shows them the truth. He has his own timing, his own ways, but it's not helpful to let somebody continue to live in a lie and just go on their way forever and ever. God's confronting them here with the truth. Here's another thing too. Justice must be served. The way that God's going to go about this, he's going to bring about judgments on them, because remember, they have been mistreating, oppressing God's own people, enslaving them, harming them, killing their children. This is not good. This is a terrible thing, and God's saying, okay, I'm going to show my glory here by bringing about some justice to the situation. He is judge, and he's going to show that. And the other thing, too, is we need to know that love is to be displayed. To love someone is to act in their best interest. It's not just warm fuzzies. I'm not neglecting that. I'm not minimizing that. I'm saying that love is about action as well. And here, God is going to be taking some action, bringing about freedom, bringing about justice to the people that call out to him, to his chosen people that have been enslaved. And all of this has to do with who God is. And that's part of what it means to see God's glory, is to see God in who he truly is, that he is really true, that he is really just, and he is really loving. And we see the way that interacts, or how he acts and interacts with the Israelites, and how it's different from the Egyptians. So we need to remember that as we go through this, that this is God's plan. This is why he has them wandering around, because he's going to do these things so that both the Israelites and the Egyptians would know the truth about who God is. Well, let's continue and see kind of how this responds, how the Egyptians respond to this. Let's look at verse 5. When the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, the mind of Pharaoh and his servants was changed toward the people, and they said, "What is this we have done, that we have let the Israel go from serving us?" Now, this probably didn't just happen, all right? I read a commentator that said that probably what they thought was, as we let them go, they're going to go 3 days out into the wilderness to sacrifice, like they asked, and they're going to come back. And when they realized, hey, these guys aren't coming back, that's probably when they had this thought. Whoa, 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 whoa. What's going on here? They're running away from us. Verse 6. So he made ready his chariot and took his army with him, and took 600 chosen chariots and all the other chariots of Egypt with officers over them. And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, and he pursued the people of Israel while the people of Israel were going out defiantly. The Egyptians pursued them, all Pharaoh's horses and chariots and his horsemen and his army, and overtook them and encamped at the sea by Pi-Hahiroth in front of Baal-Zephon. So they're meeting there, okay? Verse 10, when Pharaoh drew near, the people of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them, and they feared greatly. Remember it said they went out armed for battle? They were ready to go to battle, and here's a battle before them. And what happens? They fear greatly. It seems like the Lord knew what he was doing. He said, they're not ready for war yet, so let's go over this way. Seems like he knew what was going on. They feared greatly. The people of Israel cried out to the Lord. They said to Moses, isn't it because there are no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? What have you done to us in bringing us out of Egypt? Is this not what we said? Is this not what we said to you in Egypt? Leave us alone that we may serve the Egyptians. For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness. Man, they're here. They're faced with warriors. The Egyptians are coming towards them, and they freak out. And they start complaining, and they say, it would be better for us to go back. Let's just surrender. Let's somehow go back. Moses, you got us into this mess. Man, I can't believe we listened to this guy. And here we are. We got the sea. We're trapped in. I mean, you can tell that they're afraid. They're threatened. How do you respond when fear starts creeping into you? How do you respond? It might not be life-threatening. It could be something smaller. It might be life-threatening. But where do you turn? Where do you go when you feel like the world's crashing in? You just feel the pressure. These guys wanted to go back to Egypt. They thought it would be better there. There's safety there. There's security there. What do you turn to when you feel that fear and you just need an escape? I mean, there's lots of ways that people deal with it. Can I tell you a little bit of how I deal with it? And I'll tell you one of the greatest times that this happens to me. It's between 7:30 and 9:30 at night. At our house, we call it bedtime. I also call it D-Day, all right? It is challenging for me. It's challenging for me. I've got four kids. I'm trying to get them into bed. Melissa's helping. And my natural time during that time is like, okay, I feel the pressure. I don't want to be mad. I don't want to be angry, but I do want them to go to bed so I can have my time. I get really selfish during that time. And I'm like, okay, so here's what I got to do. And I try controlling them, but I actually don't want to do that because I love them. And I want them to go to bed. And I want them to go to bed quietly and peacefully, not angry at me or me angry at them. So a lot of times I'll retreat. I'll pull away. And I'll seek safety and comfort in a couple of things. One is I start raiding the candy closet. I just try finding food. It's like Snickers. I saw that commercial. It's satisfying. Let's see if it's right. You know, just popping it in. Nope, that's the bite-sized one. We got to find a full candy bar. You know, it's not good enough. So I'll look for something to distract me, not just to distract me, but really something in the moment that'll satisfy me. Something that I can feel good about myself to say, it's okay. The other thing, too, is I just go to my phone. I just look at a screen. I find for something for a distraction. I look for something to say, it's going to be okay. Very rarely do I actually turn to God in that moment. And I see these guys doing the same thing. How about you? When you're afraid, when the pressure's coming in, what God do you turn to? You're looking for something to satisfy you at the moment. And I'm not saying every time you pick up a Snickers, it's a terrible thing. There's lots of times I pick it up and I worship. God, thank you so much. This is a great invention. But not between 7:30 and 9. That's not what I'm thinking then. I'm looking for comfort and I'm looking for it away from the Lord. It's not an action, it's a heart. What's going on in my heart during that time? What's going on in your heart when you feel the fear? These guys, what's going on in their heart? When they complain. And we're going to see that this comes up again and again and again. I mean, did you see what they said? They said, it would have been better for us to go back and serve the Egyptians to die here. They said, it'd be better to live as a slave than to die free. That's some crazy thinking. But that's what happens when you feel a pressure situation. That's what happens when fear comes about. And look at what Moses says, how he responds. We just see Moses growing during this time. It's so good. Verse 13, Moses says to the people, fear not. Stand firm and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will work for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall never see again. The Lord will fight for you, and you only need to be silent. Maybe I should try that at bedtime. I'm just kidding, guys. I'm not going to do that. Two of my kids are in here, and they're like, now we know how to get you. But you see what Moses says? He says, fear not. Don't be afraid. He's not saying the fear that you have right now is sinful. He's saying, like, look, going forward, you don't need to be afraid. The Lord is here. He has rescued you. He is rescuing you. He will rescue you. Don't fear. God is with us. And he says, stand firm. Don't be weak. Don't be a little noodle flopping around, bending all over the place. Stand firm. Have conviction. Believe that the Lord is strong and mighty, and he will do what he has promised, because he always has done what he has promised, because he is strong enough, he is good enough, he is loving enough. He says, hang on there and see the salvation of the Lord. Not work for the salvation of the Lord. He says, see it, watch, and see what happened. Now look, there is work involved in saving these people. God does the work. There is work involved in saving us. I understand the sentiment, and I think that there's a little bit of a distortion here where people say, you know what, you're saved, not by works, but by grace, by faith. That's not exactly true. We are saved by works, but it's not our works. It's Jesus' works. It was his life that he led perfectly. It was his death on the cross. It was his resurrection. It's not us that does the saving. It's the Lord that does the saving. This is what Moses is saying at that time, and he's also already pointing ahead to the cross. See the salvation, Lord, which he will work for you today. The Egyptians who you see today, that army that you're afraid of, you'll never have to worry about them again. It's interesting, as we go through, every time the Egyptians are brought up, they're always looking back at how good it was and how bad it is currently. And the Lord says, no, you don't ever have to do that anymore. You don't have to do that again. The Lord will fight for you. You only need to be silent or be still. Don't fret. Don't run around trying to fix it for God. Do you know how much energy we waste running around doing for God things that he never asked us to do? Because we think that somehow that's going to help a situation. We make a terrible mess of our lives doing that. If we would just be still. If we would just trust and have faith. That's not to say that we should stand still and do nothing. It doesn't say anything about standing still. In fact, we're going to see that's what happens after this. Look, verse 15. The Lord says to Moses, "Why do you cry out to me? Tell the people of Israel to go forward." He's saying, "Look, Moses, I hear their complaints. I'm talking to you. You're the leader representative. Why are you calling out? Go forward." And he's like, "Forward? Forward where? There's a sea there. There's an army. You just told us that you're going to fight the battle." Let's see how God responds to this. He says, "Go forward, lift up your staff, stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it, that the people of Israel may go through the sea on dry ground. And I will harden the heart of the Egyptians so that they shall go in after them, and I will get glory over Pharaoh and all his hosts, his chariots and his horsemen. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I have gotten glory over Pharaoh, his chariots and his horsemen." He says, "Go forward, and I'm going to do something amazing." The angel of the Lord who was going before the host of Israel moved and went in and went behind them, and the pillar of cloud moved from before them and stood behind them, coming between the host of Israel and the host of Egypt. And there was a cloud and the darkness, and it lit up the night without one coming near to all the other to the other all night. That's a really confusing verse, but I like the NIV. It says, "Throughout the night the cloud brought darkness to one side and light to the other, so that neither went near the other all night long." That makes more sense. There's a cloud here, light towards Israel, darkness towards Egypt. They couldn't pass each other. And during that time, let's see what happens. Verse 21, "Then Moses stretches out his hand over the sea. The Lord drove the sea back by a strong east wind all night and made the sea dry land, and the waters were divided. And the people of Israel went into the midst of the sea on dry ground, the waters being a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. The Egyptian pursued and went in after them into the midst of the sea, all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen. And in the morning watch, the Lord in the pillar of fire and of cloud looked down on the Egyptian forces and threw the Egyptian forces into a panic, clogging their chariot wheels so that they drove heavily. And the Egyptians said, 'Let us flee from before Israel, for the Lord fights against them, for the Lord fights for them against the Egyptians.' Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Stretch out your hand over the sea, that the water may come back up upon the Egyptians, upon their chariots, upon their horsemen.' So Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the sea returned to its normal course when the morning appeared. And as the Egyptians fled into it, the Lord threw the Egyptians into the midst of the sea. The waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen and all of the host of Pharaoh that had followed them into the sea. Not one of them remained. But the people of Israel walked on dry ground through the sea, the waters being a wall to them on their right hand and on their left." Imagine what that would be like. Through that night, through that day, what did the Israelites see about the Egyptians? What did the Egyptians see about the Israelites? This passage is going to great pains to say, look, God is treating people who know him and love him and trust him differently than the people that reject him and mock him and disbelieve him. I mean, there's lots of comparisons, but between, let me just go a couple here. Israel walked out. The Egyptians, they rode out on chariots and horses. Israel walked out on dry land, where the Egyptians, they were going along and their wheels got heavy and clogged. It seems like the dry land became muddy, that they weren't able to pass through it. Israel went between a supernatural water that were two walls. But the Egyptians, when they walked through it, it said that the water returned to normal course. And it crashed in on them. Israel was brought out of Egypt by the Lord. But verse 27 says, the Lord threw the Egyptians into the midst of the sea. Israel was freed from slavery. But we see here that the Egyptians become captured by the sea. They're never going to escape. The biggest one is that Israel lives, where the Egyptians die. We see a clear contrast where God is working to save some who know and trust him, who have responded to his invitation to believe and make him their God, to where he is bringing judgment upon those who have not. There's just two options within the story. And the same is true for us today. I mean, the Lord is very clear to talk about how that we either accept him or we reject him. We have faith or we don't have faith. We believe and follow, or we go our own way, following lots of different things. I mean, here are a couple words from Jesus. Enter by the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the way is easy that leads to destruction, and those who enter by it are many. For the gate is narrow and the way is hard that leads to life, and those who find it are few. He makes it even more clear. Here's Jesus saying, Jesus says to them again, truly, truly, I say to you, I am the door of the sheep. All who came before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not listen to them. I am the door. If anyone enters by me, he will be saved and go in and out and find pasture, life, food, sustenance. The thief comes only to steal, kill, and destroy. I came that they may have life and have it abundantly. Jesus makes it very clear. Put your faith in him. Trust in him, in his life, his death on the cross, his resurrection. And that's how we have forgiveness and righteousness given to us. Not that we earn it, but it is credited to us by faith because he's so good, his grace. He gives it to us freely as we believe and surrender to him. What is the response that we see when God does a magnificent work? I mean, that's what these Israelites are looking at. As we pick it up here, we're going to close in verse 30 and 31. They just saw this miracle. They just walked across through the Red Sea or the Reed Sea. They went through this place, dry land, and they saw that the Egyptians were not able to chase them. Verse 30, thus the Lord saved Israel on that day from the hand of the Egyptians. And Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. That is a heavy scene. That is a heavy scene. The contrast of life and death, of salvation and judgment could not be clearer to them. And it made an impact on their hearts. And we see that their hearts were not hardened. Instead, this is how they responded. At verse 31, Israel saw the great power the Lord used against the Egyptians. So the people feared the Lord. Not like a cowering way, but oh my goodness, look how great and awesome this God is that just rescued us. I'm a little bit nervous of what he can do. When you are in the midst of great powers, if you're comfortable, then you're not understanding the situation. I've said it before. If you walk into a room with Navy SEALs and you're just like, what's up? I feel comfortable. Like there's something wrong with you. You don't understand the situation. You should have a little bit of fear. You should be a little bit nervous of what's going on. But you should also feel greatly safe. Unless you've done something to make them mad, and then you should get out. But we're in the midst of great power that is for us. You're a little bit nervous, but you should feel very safe. So they feared the Lord and they believed in the Lord and in his servant, Moses. They believed. That's the question for you. Do you believe? Do you believe that Jesus has made a way that you can pass away from the enemies that are trying to kill you? That through the cross, like through the Red Sea, that you can have life. You can be delivered. You can be brought into a relationship where God will be your God, will be your King, will be your father, and you will feel safe, secure, like a child should feel with a good parent. This is the picture that we have, not because of ourselves. What did Israel do? They did nothing. God loved them. He chose them. It was all grace that got them to this situation. And this time, for this moment, they get it right that they believe. It's not always so. We'll see as we read through. They don't always believe, but at this moment, when it counted, they did believe. What about you? Do you have faith in Christ to rescue you from your sin, from your problems, to deliver you when you have the pressure coming in? There's a way to live righteous and holy because you have a soft heart and because the Spirit empowers you when you have faith. Not because you're good, but because Jesus was good for us and we're trusting him. I encourage you, if you've never made that choice, make it today. Don't let your heart be hardened. Don't end up like Dawkins, thinking that this Old Testament God is a bad God. No, he is a good God. He's a loving God. He's a saving God. But he is a just God. You will not be mocked. Ask for forgiveness. Ask to be brought into his family because of what Jesus has done. Let me pray, and then we'll finish out with a closing song. God, we thank you that you love us. We thank you that you have made yourself known and clear through your word. Help us to understand it. It is not easy for us to get that. But with your Spirit's help, we can believe. We ask that you would give us hearts of flesh, not hearts of stone, that we would be soft towards you. We would not push away, but we would see how kind and loving and forgiving and merciful you are, and we would run to you. We would see how bad sin is, how terrible the judgment is, and we would run from that towards you. God, we want real life, true, abundant life. Thank you that it's found in you, Christ. Let us enjoy it. Let us tell others about it. And help us to pray and pray and pray for those who are far from you, as many have prayed for us when we've been far from you. We lift you up. You are the true God. We ask this in your name. Amen.